Who among us doesn't appreciate it when someone asks us what we think? We like it when our opinions are valued. Moms and dads, if you want to kick your son or daughter's self-image up a notch or two, just ask for their input. Ask them to help you make a decision. Kids, if you want to do the same thing for a younger brother or sister, you know, kick up their self-image a bit, how they feel about themselves. Empower them by, you know, letting them know that what they say makes a difference. I know that's a tough thing to ask for, but it can happen. And all of you kids, when you get to thinking as though your parents are completely clueless, which isn't true, but I know it seems like that, try the same thing with them. Parents know what powerlessness feels like. I think everyone would benefit if we would spend more time finding out what someone else thinks and less time trying to inflict our own thoughts and opinions on other people. It was the summer of 1977. My family had been vacationing at Stone Harbor, New Jersey, off and on for about 20 years at that point. That particular summer, my folks rented a place that was big enough to accommodate all of us, which at that point in time consisted of my parents, my mom and dad, my sister, me and my two brothers. There were three spouses at that point, two grandchildren, and we had another grandchild on the way. And it was great. And my dad, who was always the fiscal conservative, but he was very big into family, he started seriously thinking about buying a place at Stone Harbor. I was 26 years old at the time, and it is so vivid in my memory. I remember my dad taking me aside and saying, "Jim, what do you think about this?" It was the first time I can ever remember my dad asking me for my opinion about anything, especially something as large as a real estate transaction. That was 30 years ago, or just about 30 years ago. I have never forgotten how it felt to have my opinion valued. For a couple of years, I've been doing online surveys. Not only do they value my opinion, they give me points to tell them what I think. Points are a good thing. Right now, I have 6,340 points. As soon as I earn another 193,660 points, I am getting a John Deere riding lawnmower. And so, if Willard Scott can't reach me to say happy birthday, just tell him I'm in my backyard trying out my brand new John Deere. Well, this outfit that does the online surveys, they did a quick survey last week. This is one they just ask you one question, you answer it yes or no. They don't even give you any points for it, but I answered anyways. And the question was, if the United States, do you think that the United States should phase out the use of pennies? Should we phase out the use of pennies? I said, no, of course not. Why would you want to abandon pennies? Can you imagine singing, "Every time it rains, nickels from heaven"? You know, it just does not work. Or for those of us from the 60s, "Dollar Lane, the barber shaves another customer," you know. A 50-cent piece saved is a 50-cent piece earned. That just loses the character of the whole thing. And, you know, come on now. Do we want to start wearing dime loafers? I don't think so. That's just wrong. Pennies are part of our culture. And even if some folks think that they are just small and worthless, with very little in the way of purchasing power, that they're nothing more than a nuisance, no. They're part of who we are. And you realize, folks, if somebody asks you that question, if we eliminate pennies, when the gas prices go up, it won't be by 1 or 2 cents. It'll always have to be by 5 cents. And we certainly don't want to see that happen. Well, one day Jesus was doing a bit of people watching. He was doing a little research project. And he positions himself where he has a good view of the temple treasury, the box or jar container where people place their offerings. The Jews don't pass offering plates in worship. They didn't then. They don't do that today. Their giving is separate from worship. So Jesus finds himself a place to sit where people aren't going to notice him. That's called non-participant observation. He watches as a widow places two little copper coins in the offering container. Now, this story is traditionally called the widow's mite. And mite refers to something really, really small, not much more than a speck. In this case, it's a couple of worthless coins. And in her case, that speck, that mite, represented everything that that widow owned in the world. And she put it all in the offering. This story really isn't about coins, little tiny coins with almost no value. It is about the widows of Jesus' day and about other people who are treated kind of like those coins, who are treated as though they are worthless. Women of that day had babies, they prepared meals, they raised the children, they cared for the house. Those were the functions, and only those functions, that gave them value. Apparently, this particular widow, kind of like Naomi, was not only without a husband, she didn't have any sons to take care of her either, nor did she have a brother-in-law or a close relative who would take her into his house as his wife. She had no one. She had nothing. She was basically worthless. And in that culture, she had no power to change her situation. She was powerless. Now, people like those long-robed scribes who were a lot like the star-bellied Sneetches, if you were a Dr. Seuss fan, the ones with stars on thars, and the rich people bringing their large offerings, these people who had the power to change this poor widow's situation, didn't. Now, the Bible is not a roadmap. It's not a rule book. It's not an instructional manual, despite what you hear people say. It's none of those things. It is a collection of writings about power. Who has it? Who wants it? Who had it but lost it? How it goes to people's heads? How it is used, abused, misused? How it gets transferred from one person to another or from one group to another? Sometimes, as we see in the United States after we've had an election, it happens in a semi-orderly fashion after you get beyond the campaigning and all that sort of thing. But more often than not, when power goes from one person to another, or one group to another, it happens in somewhat of a disorderly fashion. That's what happens in the Bible over and over again. Where does God fit into this? Well, God is how we wrestle with power issues, trying to make sense of what just seems senseless and figure out where the justice is to be found in the midst of one heck of a mess. God is that perspective that allows us to stand at a distance from the mess and the insanity, kind of like Jesus sitting across from the temple treasury, where we can observe and analyze, kind of ponder, think, and hopefully come up with a better way of being God's creation. It can be different than what we've experienced. We can be different. We can be better. Well, kids are little creatures. Well, maybe not that small. Maybe that small. Mites. In Jesus' day, they were a lot like widows. They couldn't generate any income. There was no guarantee that they'd even survive. Now, of course, the same is true for today, but the odds for survival are a lot better today than they were back in the first century. Why do you think, according to the tradition, that boys became adults when they hit their teens? I mean, it was if they had been able to survive the first 12 years of life, then the time came to consider them real people. They were physically able to be of value to the family rather than just being a drain on the family, on its resources, or just a worry whether or not they were going to live. And so parents would have been reluctant to get too attached or to invest much in a child. Unlike today, a problem pregnancy or delivery almost always spelled disaster. And even if a baby made it into the world alive, there was a high probability that the disease or injury would prevent him or her from reaching adulthood. Not that many kids made it. So to survive beyond childhood was a big deal, worthy of a major celebration. They call it a bar mitzvah, which means a son of the command. What was that command? I will be your God, and you will be my people. That's it in a nutshell. Anything beyond that is commentary. I will be your God and you will be my people. This is your identity. This is your story. This is who you are. This is what gives you power. The realization that you are a child of God, that you are valuable, that you have great worth, that gives you power. Now, the last time I checked, we didn't live in the first century. More often than not, our children survive to become youth. And our youth survive, sometimes against their parents' better judgment, to become adults. We let them live. I keep saying to my 30-year-old son, who is a really nice guy, and he's a good dad now, and I say, Joshua, I am so glad I let you live. There were moments I wasn't too sure if I was going to. Parents, you invest a lot in your kids from the very beginning. You don't wait to see if they're going to make it before you get attached to them. You value them even if in most cases they are not in a position to generate income for the family. And kids, you might have chores to do that you might get paid for and you might not, and that you might like doing or you might not. But all that doesn't make a difference because you are valuable just the way you are, as Mr. Rogers would say, without a doubt or question, or even a suggestion, not by far. You are valuable just the way you are. And we need to bring that perspective. We need to value our young people in the church. They have a perspective. They have a way of seeing things. They have a way of expressing the faith that is unique to them. And so we need to value their opinions. But here's the deal. In order to maximize their input, we adults need to listen to them with new ears. Teens don't see things the way that the children see them. Children don't see things the way that teens see them. Neither of them see things the way that adults see them. We have children being children for such a short period of time, and teenagers being teenagers for such a short period of time, which means that we have to listen to them quick. They bring a perspective that we will only have access to for a very brief period of time. Young people, you are in a position to teach us older people something about what we need to do to reach out to those who might be curious about the faith, who might be wondering what goes on in the church, but they have trouble kind of making their way through the maze of cliches and slogans and kind of inside information, kind of like the inside jokes that we have as Christian people. Kids remember what it feels like, or they know what it feels like, not to altogether fit in, because they don't completely understand what other people seem to understand. And so, kids, you can remind us. You can remind us. You can help us to be more sensitive to those who stand out there on the edges of the faith somewhere, trying to decide, I wonder if I'll give this thing called church, this thing called faith, a try. Several years ago, there was a major gathering in Fort Worth, Texas, of United Methodists from all across the country. In fact, this gathering was called, very cleverly, The Gathering of United Methodists. Great title. Well, it said it like it was. Nobody came together and voted on anything. They weren't electing bishops or deciding priorities for the church. They just came together to learn and to be inspired. And it was inspiring. I was there doing workshops and enjoyed it. But I have to confess that when the opening worship service started, as beautiful and as well designed as it was, it just didn't move me until the children showed up. Then it was worship. We weren't the church until we were there in all our fullness. And we are less than full. We are less than complete. We're less than whole when our young people are absent. The smallest ones, the mites, the ones we tend to overlook, they can make such a difference. It was the mites, the little ones, whom Jesus chose to associate with, to be intimate with, whether they were widows or tax collectors or lepers or sinners or children. And Jesus knew that a person could not disassociate himself or herself with these little ones and still know the presence of God. This morning, as we receive Holy Communion, you're not going to receive a full loaf of bread, each one of you, or even a full slice of bread. If you skipped your juice this morning for breakfast, most likely you're not going to be satisfied with the little taste of juice that you're going to get here this morning. You're going to get just a mite. That's all you're going to get, just a mite. But with that mite, that little bit, that seemingly worthless little bit, we have the opportunity to know ourselves in the presence of the God who has been revealed to us in Jesus Christ, the one who had such respect for, such love for, such care for the little ones. Just a mite, but don't miss it. In the name of the Father, and of the Son, and of the Holy Spirit. Amen.